Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation and Criminal Law Practice Groups, was recorded on Monday, August 8, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss the Microsoft Warrants case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to our call two experts today. We're going to hear opening remarks from each, and then, as always, questions from the audience. So do be thinking of your questions in advance, please. We'll get opening remarks first from Jeffrey M. Harris. He's a partner at Bancroft, and you should know that Bancroft does have Microsoft as one of its clients, although I understand it didn't argue this case. Mr. Harris will be presenting his views only and not those of Microsoft or, I guess, of Bancroft. He'll give us some background on the case for those of you who aren't really familiar with it, and then talk about how the case got to where it is and the decision and its implications. And then we'll hear opening remarks as well from Professor Jamil N. Jaffer. He's an adjunct professor of law and director of the Homeland and National Security Law Program at the George Mason University School of Law. I suppose that is now the Scalia, the Antonin Scalia School of Law School. And he is also former counsel to Assistant Attorney General in the National Security Division. With that, let's get the opening remarks from Mr. Harris. The floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Dean. Good to be here with you and Jamil. So I'll first up just give a quick summary of what happened in the case and then sort of give my initial spin on it. So this is a really interesting case that raises a number of really important issues of both national sovereignty and electronic privacy. So two sort of very weighty areas of law that don't normally intersect that sort of come together in this really interesting dispute about sort of what happens when data crosses national borders. So this decision came out in July. It was issued by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. And the basic question before the court in the Microsoft case is, when can the U.S. government compel a U.S. company to produce data that is stored on a server in a foreign country? So the government issued a warrant to Microsoft demanding that Microsoft turn over the contents of one of its customers' email accounts. But all of the data in question was stored on a server in Dublin, Ireland. And so it was over there, it was subject to a different set of rules under both Irish law and European Union law. So the government's position in the case was that this warrant was permissible because it was directed to a U.S. company, Microsoft, to produce records in its custody. So according to the government, a federal court can issue this warrant and order the production of documents located anywhere in the world as long as it has personal jurisdiction over the person in possession or control of the material. So the government said, at the end of the day, this is domestic because Microsoft is a domestic company and, you know, we don't care where your data is stored. We just want it. And so it's up to Microsoft to bring it back to the United States. And the government relied pretty heavily on some cases about banking records, which had held that if the U.S. gives a subpoena to the New York branch of a Swiss bank, for example, that bank can be compelled to produce records about customers, even if they're held in another country. So Microsoft, on the other hand, took a very different view of the whole dispute, unsurprisingly. And Microsoft's basic position was, this is extraterritorial application of U.S. law. So the Supreme Court's held for a really long time that unless Congress speaks clearly, federal statutes should only have domestic application, and they should only apply within the United States. And Microsoft said, this is a classic extraterritorial search beyond the boundaries of the United States. And so Microsoft's core position is that when data is stored on a server in a foreign country, it should be subject to the electronic privacy laws of that country, and any disclosure would have to take account of those laws. Microsoft also relied heavily on these treaties called Mutual Legal Assistance Treaties, or MLATs, and the U.S. has entered into a number of these including with European countries. And what the MLATs do is they allow law enforcement in different countries to make requests of one another to help in investigations. And so Microsoft's position was, any of these requests should be going through the MLAT process, not through, hitting the provider with a subpoena. And Microsoft also argued that it was being sort of left between a rock and a hard place because, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, much of this information is subject to heightened protections under European or Irish law. And so Microsoft said, we have no good options if we're required to produce this because our choices would be either violate the subpoena, don't comply with the subpoena and find itself in contempt of court in New York, or if it complied with the subpoena, it could then find itself the subject of a criminal probe or an enforcement action in Europe for disclosing customer information in violation of EU law. So the district court issued the warrant and rejected all of Microsoft's arguments and basically said, this is just a subpoena for records, and so, it's served on a U.S. company and therefore nothing to see here. But the Second Circuit unanimously reversed, and the Second Circuit basically relied on the presumption against extraterritoriality and said the relevant statute, which is called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, neither explicitly nor implicitly envisioned the application of its warrant provisions overseas. And for example, the government had argued that, because nothing prohibited it from seeking information stored overseas, therefore it had this authority. But the Second Circuit held that that was pretty much exactly backwards because the presumption against extraterritoriality means that if a statute's ambiguous, it means that it should only have domestic application. And the Second Circuit also distinguished some of the cases about subpoenas because they said the cases about Swiss banks, for example, all involved actual records of the bank. And so there's a difference between a bank producing its own records that might show, the balance in an account or the customer's information as opposed to emails, where I think the Second Circuit really had a view that the emails belong to the subscriber and not to Microsoft. And it described Microsoft as a caretaker for the individuals that had protected privacy interests in their emails. And finally, and I think this is important to the court's holding, the Second Circuit emphasized that its holding serves the interests of international comity because it prevents conflicts between U.S. law and electronic privacy laws of other countries. So that was the holding. So the court basically vacated the warrant and held that to allow the U.S. government to subpoena Microsoft for emails stored in Ireland would be an unlawful extraterritorial application of U.S. law. My take on this decision, I think it's hugely important. So one important takeaway is ECPA, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which is the law in this area, it was passed in 1986. At that time, the internet was really just a fringe technology that was used by, hobbyists and academic researchers. And so I think the Second Circuit's decision is hugely important at the most basic level because it gives some guidance about how ECPA applies to changing technologies. When you have this statute that's completely out of date and, could not even remotely contemplate what the internet would evolve to look like. So just getting some guidance at all is a big step that I think is helpful for everyone, government and tech companies alike. And then on the merits, I also think that it really rests on some pretty core principles of U.S. law. So I think a lot of the press coverage has described this decision as being about electronic privacy, and that's definitely true. I mean, it is about interpreting a statute about electronic privacy. But I actually think that the case is really much more about foreign sovereignty and international comity. And I think the big takeaway from the Microsoft decision is that each country has primary authority within its own borders to determine when law enforcement is allowed to access customers' private data. So, I think it recognizes that Ireland gets to decide when law enforcement gets to access data in Ireland, the U.S. gets to decide in the U.S., and each country gets to make that decision for itself. And to the extent there's a conflict or to the extent we're not sure of which law applies, that's when you resolve it on a government-to-government basis through this treaty process, through an MLAT request. And what's really important about MLATs is that they're discretionary and they have a built-in safety valve. So if, let's say in this case, rather than doing what it did, if the government had gone to the government of Ireland and said, hey, we need these emails, Ireland, we need you to make a request of Microsoft in Ireland to turn over these emails. And if the government of Ireland had said, heck no, you know, this violates our own privacy laws, it violates local law, we choose not to comply with this, the MLAT process respects and recognizes that. And so I think whereas what the government did here has a lot of potential for international friction and international disputes, I think the MLAT process has a built-in way to resolve those on a government-to-government basis. And so what the government was trying to do was to take a shortcut by going directly to Microsoft when it should have gone to the other government and resolved this on a sovereign-to-sovereign basis. So I think there's also some really serious conflict of law issues that this decision helps avoid. So what this basically recognizes is that other countries are allowed to have stricter privacy protections than the United States. And so there was actually an amicus brief filed in support of Microsoft by a member of the EU Parliament who had taken the lead on a lot of privacy issues, and he said that disclosure of the information that the U.S. government was seeking likely would have violated EU law. So again, I think it wasn't just hypothetical. I think there was actually good reason to believe that had this warrant been enforced, that Microsoft essentially would have been required by a U.S. court to violate the law of a country in which it did business. As sort of a practical level too, this decision is extremely important for the U.S. tech industry because I think there's a widespread perception, which is probably unfair in the rest of the world, that U.S. privacy protections are not very strict and that the U.S. doesn't take privacy seriously and that the EU is more enlightened when it comes to protecting electronic information. And so if this warrant had been allowed to proceed, that would have been disastrous for Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, any company that does business in Europe, because I think Europeans are already kind of skittish about trusting their data to U.S. companies and would have absolutely been less likely to do so if they thought that the U.S. government could be snooping around in their private data just by going straight to the provider. So I think the decision is right on the law, and I think it's fundamentally designed to prevent friction between countries, and I think it's also it's extremely important just for the health of the U.S. tech industry and its ability to serve customers around the world. So I'll stop there and turn it over to Jamil for his take on it.
Well, thanks, Jeff. I think that it's interesting. We probably start where Jeff began, where Jeff ended, which is to say that this opinion somehow helps preserve international comity and promote protection of user privacy and the like. I actually think the decision actually cuts in exactly the opposite direction. And the reason why is fairly simple. The most likely outcome of this legislation is, in fact, not that countries will choose to respect the more aggressive privacy laws of foreign sovereigns, but rather to require companies that are headquartered in their jurisdictions to localize data. And the reason being very simple. If a given country has a given set of protections for users and a given set of procedures for users to obtain that information, whether it's content or non-content data, the government's likely to want those rules to apply. And so where they're unlikely to allow users to benefit from more aggressive privacy protections overseas because they've made that judgment in their own country, as we did here, as to when the rules apply to content data or non-content data. And given that, where a country has a higher standard, it's not likely that they're likely to defer. They're more likely to actually use their own interests, put their own interests at stake, and in fact, lower the bar by requiring data to be localized in their country. Now, to be sure, the technology companies, as they did here, are likely to fight that outcome, as it is hugely problematic for cloud-based storage and all the reasons that technology companies want to distribute their data to various points local and closer to the users, or for other reasons, whether it's cost or otherwise. But unfortunately, the perverse outcome of a ruling that ended up in the technology industry's favor, at least their advocacy, is more likely to result in more costs and worse outcomes for the cloud, if in fact I'm right that data localization is the likely outcome of this decision. More importantly, I think, the real question here is, how and when the U.S. should be able to have access to data. And as Jeff will, I think, as we'll talk about later on, in the aftermath of this ruling, assuming that it's not overturned by the Supreme Court, there's going to be a conversation about how and when the United States is able to access data, and what data they're able to access and under what rules and overseas when it comes to U.S. providers and the like. The real problem here is that Microsoft sort of now has the ability to put its data anywhere it determines is better for its own interest, whether that's economically or to protect users' privacy. And so, and that's fine, but that simply means that, that Microsoft has allowed itself, has been allowed essentially to exempt itself from U.S. law, even though it's a U.S. company, and take advantage of whatever the rules are overseas, whether more generous or less generous overseas. And so, of course, our normal rule is where we decide to serve the subpoena matters, serve the warrant at least matters to some extent. And in fact, in this context, the rules committee of the Federal Judiciary has actually modified the rules over time to permit it to be not where the data is located, but from where the provider is located. And so, that was at least the government's argument below that convinced the magistrate judge. The Second Circuit, of course, made hash of that. And I think the other interesting thing is, as a general matter, the warrant requirement is not enforced as against U.S. citizens even located overseas, in part because, warrants are dead letters overseas, with the exception that through the MLAT process, as a general matter, U.S. warrants granted here in the United States don't apply overseas. And so it's interesting because the presumption against extraterritoriality applies to the use of a U.S. warrant overseas, and therefore where information is obtained in a warrantless through warrantless means overseas, they can still be used in U.S. court. And yet here, we're using presumption against extraterritoriality in exactly the opposite direction. And so it's interesting. I think that the courts are going to have to sort out which version of the presumption they prefer, right? Is the presumption that protects U.S. persons overseas by not allowing us to use U.S. laws to obtain information overseas, or is it the U.S. laws simply don't apply at all overseas, and therefore if the government is able to obtain it without provider compliance, that then it doesn't matter and can be used against a U.S. person in federal court. And so I think that's some of the challenges here. Ultimately, I think the outcome here, while appearing on its face to be beneficial to privacy of users, in fact, I think actually cuts against that. I think it's more likely that U.S. persons are likely to be subject to increased government surveillance as an outcome of this as the legislative branch plays this thing out. And I know there are some new legislation out there that would, in fact, heighten protections. I actually think that it's unlikely in the new scenario we find ourselves in post-Brussels, post-Paris, and San Bernardino and the like that we're likely to see those laws enacted. In fact, I think we're moving the opposite direction. In fact, Europe is in fact moving the opposite direction with their surveillance laws. So I think net-net, an outcome that looks good for privacy, looks good for U.S. companies, actually likely to be bad for privacy and bad for U.S. companies going forward.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for those first thoughts. I want to give Jeff Harris a chance to respond. Before I do that, let's open the floor to questions and let people begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on our telephone. The lines are wide open. Jeff Harris, a chance to respond. And in your response, maybe you could address two quick questions. I think that can be addressed pretty quickly. One, a factual question. Is it the case that the data at issue here could be accessed by Microsoft from its offices in the U.S.? And does that make a difference as a legal proposition? And two, even maybe more fundamentally, is today's discussion limited to law enforcement, or would it also have an impact on national security issues?
Sure. So this is Jeff. So to start with sort of Jamil's point about data localization, so that's a real concern. I mean, I think what this is some countries, the fear, some law enforcement, mostly from that community, have expressed concern that with decisions like this, countries may enact laws that essentially force tech companies to store citizens' data in the country where they live, regardless of, like Jamil said, cost or efficiency or anything like that. So that's a real thing. I mean, it's not out of the question that that will happen and sort of has been happening. But I think there are also reasons for localization that don't have anything to do with the law in this area. And the main one is it's easier and faster to access data when the data is stored near the person who's accessing it. So for perfectly legitimate business reasons that have nothing to do with any of this, providers are generally going to want to keep the data near the customers who are accessing it. So, you know, I don't dispute that this decision could push things a little bit towards the localization, but I think that's something that's already happening and would likely continue to happen regardless of the decision. And I think in terms of consequences, the important thing to think about is what the consequences would be if this decision had gone the other way. And I think if this had gone the other way and sent a signal that, hey, if you ever need someone's emails, just go straight to the tech company, I think that's a disastrous and frankly dangerous precedent. So, you know, the obvious hypothetical is, what if the Russian police had walked into Google's Moscow office and served a warrant that said, hey, we think Jamil Jaffer is engaged in espionage and crimes against Russia, and we would like you, Google, to give us all emails in your custody to or from Jamil Jaffer over the last 2 years. And I think, you know, if that happened today, I think Google would correctly tell the Russian government, you know, pound sand, take it to your embassy. But I think if the U.S. government establishes a precedent of essentially using the tech companies as intermediaries to pursue leads in international law enforcement, I think it sets a terrible precedent. And I think if the U.S. government doesn't want other countries to do that to our citizens, I think we, you know, need to extend the same respect to things stored in their country and to their citizens. So to Dean's other questions, then, you know, I think it was undisputed, and the parties had largely stipulated all the facts. I think it was undisputed that Microsoft could have accessed this data. But I think for reasons of where the customer was located, it was also undisputed that the data was physically on a server in Ireland and was not on a server in the United States. So again, it would have meant Microsoft having to essentially bring the data back from Ireland and then turn it over to the government, which I think that's a little odd to think of a warrant in that sense, because normally you think of a warrant as law enforcement gets the warrant and then it can search your house or your car or arrest you. But it's odd to think of that as essentially compelling a company to bring data to the United States and turn it over. And so I think, and this comes through in the opinion, the statute does use the word warrant, and there's a very long history of warrants being enforced only in the United States. And I think that history really helped inform the Second Circuit's view of what warrant in this statute meant. And then your other question, I think, was about the national security community. And, you know, Jamil may be better positioned than me to address that. I mean, I think this would only affect sort of law enforcement investigations. And so I'm just not as familiar with the sort of NSA type issues, but I think this is only a construction of Section 2703. And so what the Electronic Communications Privacy Act does is it establishes very strict protections of electronic information and then creates exceptions, including through the 2703 warrant rule, which is what's at issue here. But it's only a gloss on that rule. It doesn't affect any other statutory or constitutional authority of the government to engage in, national security type activities.
Jamil, let's hear from you on what he just said. Before we do that, let me ask again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open, so if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. So, Jamil Jaffer, if you could address whether or not this case concerns national security matters, And then maybe if you could go into some of the more practical implications of this decision. Camille Jaffer.
Sure. So, yeah. So, of course, as you know, the 2703D rule or approach obtaining of orders to obtain certain kinds of content and warrants and non-content out of the entire 2703 structure, ECPA, applies principally to law enforcement investigations, although, you know, a lot of times, as we learned sort of post-9/11, there's a lot of overlap between criminal and national security investigations, and, you know, we've taken down sort of the informal or semi-formal walls that existed between those two. And so oftentimes governments will use blended authorities, the U.S. government will use blended authorities using 2703D in some contexts, using other, whether it's Section 215 or other authorities for non-content data in that case, or FISA for content data as applicable. And so oftentimes they'll blend these authorities and make a determination on how to proceed forward. So it could have an impact on national security investigations. But, you know, the larger issue, I think, that as Jeff was getting to at the beginning of his point was, you know, about data localization. And, you know, Jeff made the point correctly that there has been a point towards push towards localization by companies. But that push, as Jeff points out, is to push information to the edge so it's closest to users. The localization that I'm talking about is sort of enforced localization by nation states requiring storage of customer data to be stored in their country so that their laws can apply, and that so perhaps stronger or different rules from other foreign countries don't apply. And that actually cuts in the opposite direction, because then companies are not permitted to store it close to the customer where it might be most efficient or in the lowest cost provider, but in fact in the country in which they either their user resides, in the case of the new Russian laws, or potentially in other cases in the case of some European countries that are considering it, in Europe where the company is headquartered. And so that creates all sorts of problems because, A, it results in inefficient use of resources. It makes it harder for customers to get access to data. And to the extent that these countries that are applying their laws have a lower standard, whether it's the U.S. standard happens to be lower or the European standard or the Russian or the Chinese standard, then all of a sudden it's the lowest common denominator. And so, in a perverse way, this decision highlights the fact that if you want to get data under your own laws, the best way to, whatever those laws might be, the best way to do it is to require either a provider that's headquartered in your country to store all of its data locally in your country, or store all of its users that are your citizens in its country, as in the case of Russia. And so net, this decision looks good for Microsoft, looks good for user privacy, but likely to result in countries forcing the most inefficient and least privacy protective rule upon consumers and companies.
Once again, our lines are wide open. It's a reticent audience here today. Push the star button, then the pound button if you have a question. Let me ask a question I suppose this might be for Jamil Jaffer as well. The MLAT process was mentioned by Jeff Harris. Is that too cumbersome? Is there a way to streamline that to maybe alleviate some concerns about whether or not that is too cumbersome? And maybe you can describe it again for our audience.
Sure. So the MLAT process, depending on, first of all, you have to have an agreement, a mutual legal systems treaty, an MLAT agreement with that foreign country in order to avail yourself of that benefit. And so assuming we have one of those in place, which we don't with a lot of countries, but assuming we have that in place, there are procedures by which you submit a request, then that request goes to that country's sort of enforcement process. They can make decisions about what to do and see whether it meets their laws. And then, as Jeff pointed out very correctly, there are safety valves and escape routes for governments that choose not to comply. And at the end of the day, you know, these treaties work to the extent that the countries are willing to come together and agree on sort of the set of rules under which they're going to give enforcement ability to the other country's process. And so, you know, yes, they're a process. It is long, it is cumbersome, it is slow. In fast-moving investigations, admittedly, this was a drug case, but, you know, a lot of these fast-moving terrorism investigations, an MLAT process is a death knell. And actually, what we've found with the U.S. government in cases of national security, oftentimes will simply go to the country outside the MLAT process and enforce our rules, even against U.S. citizens, enforce our desires to obtain information overseas. And U.S. courts have long held that because the Fourth Amendment itself doesn't apply extraterritorially, the American users who have data or information overseas don't get the benefits of our Fourth Amendment rules, and therefore they can bring that data back, use it in a federal proceeding, and there's and even though it was obtained without a warrant, because it was obtained overseas, even outside of an NLAP process, American users' privacy, again, is harmed. And so, again, the underlying holding relying on the presumption against extraterritoriality, while sounds good in this case for the privacy of Microsoft account holders, in fact has been used regularly, and it's sort of longstanding law since Verdugo-Ortiz, that's actually been sort of counterproductive to the interests of privacy advocates and the like. And so, again, I would sort of caution against, sort of being super excited if you're a privacy advocate or a tech company for different reasons about this holding, because it ultimately underlines a presumption that has cut against privacy in the past, and it underlines a trend and sort of perhaps emboldens the trend towards validation that ultimately will not benefit companies. So, you know, sort of a worry that Microsoft got a little more than it asked for here with this ruling, even though it came out in its favor.
I'm going to give Jeff Harris, this is Dean, Jeff Harris, a chance to respond to that point in particular, Jeff, if you want to, and that is that maybe Microsoft is getting a result here, maybe some unintended consequences. Jeff Harris.
Sure. So a few notes on MLATs. So, you know, I think that it's, at least in a few of the most high-profile incidents, I think there have been instances in which the MLAT process has actually worked almost in real time. So I think after the Charlie Hebdo Paris attacks, for example, it was determined that one of the suspects had a Microsoft email account. And I think, you know, French officials contacted U.S. officials who contacted Microsoft. And I think within 45 minutes of the attacks, the French authorities had the emails they needed. So I think there's no question that the process can work quickly when it needs to work quickly. You know, but to the extent the MLAT process is slow and cumbersome, I think that absolutely is true as an empirical matter that it can be, but that may not always be a bad thing. I mean, our government has a lot of built-in, delays and, cumbersome things in its structural constitutional provisions. And if the alternative is a super fast process that violates the local laws of countries where the data are stored, then I think, you know, slow and cumbersome might not be that bad because, as, you know, as I said originally, and as I think, you know, Jamil agreed, I think part of this MLAT process is the government that gets a request looking closely at that request and saying, boy, should I give this information to the U.S. or will this violate our own local laws if I give this away? You know, and the last thing I'd say about the MLAT process, I just think what's most important about the MLAT process is it's government to government. And so, again, when there's a need for information in another country or about another country's citizens, I think it seems like the best way to resolve that is for the governments to talk, figure it out, and then go to and then the government goes to the relevant provider in the country where it's stored, rather than sticking the provider in the middle, which can often lead to these very impossible situations. And again, I think if this warrant had been enforced and Microsoft would have been forced to turn over this information in violation of EU privacy laws about sending data to the United States, I think that's a really tough spot. And I think the MLAT process is specifically designed to avoid making a company be the go-between between two governments. And it just recognizes that when I need information about someone else's citizens, the governments talk to each other instead of talking to the tech companies.
Interesting. Once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I begin to think, gentlemen, the question and answer function isn't working on our system here, but let us carry on nevertheless. I want to hear from Jamil Jaffer, if we could, on the point that Jeff Harris made on comity or reciprocity, and that is, had the case come out differently, the United States, people here in the United States would be vulnerable to a process originated in a foreign country that gets to data housed here in the United States.
Well, so, I mean, to some extent, that's already true, right? I mean, For example, China and Russia have required companies like Google and Microsoft and other companies to store data locally, at least with respect to their citizens or data that's being used in their country. Now, the question is, well, what about if they're able to get access to data here? Well, if it's a Chinese company, right, you know, there's an argument to be made that that a Chinese company subject to Chinese law has to abide by that. And so somebody, a user, can vote with their feet. If they don't want the Chinese government getting access to their data, they can choose to use a provider that is not headquartered in China. Same with Microsoft. If a user does not want the U.S. government getting access to Microsoft data, if in fact the ruling had come out differently, they can choose to use a foreign provider. I mean, that's actually in part what companies like Microsoft and Google are concerned about. But of course, the problem is they're the view of the law that the Second Circuit has espoused and that Jeff has just described is a one-way ratchet. It's a one-way ratchet that lets the most aggressive bar on government access to data apply. And where a country has made a decision, right, where its political process has decided, okay, the rules that apply in our country for access to data are the following, A, B, C, D, and E, and if you're a U.S. company or you store the data in the U.S., those rules you have to comply with. At least that's for companies that don't store the data here but choose to put it overseas, even though their headquarters are here, even though their lawyers are here, even though they've chosen to take advantage of the benefits of U.S. law, they need not comply with U.S. access to data laws because they can simply store the data in a place where they're exempt from U.S. jurisdiction. You know, in a lot of ways, there are strong parallels between Microsoft's argument here and Apple's argument in the iPhone case, which is simply, look, we get that you've got rules and procedures by which we're supposed to comply with and give you access to data, but we're just going to choose to opt out of that. In the case of Microsoft, they store the data in Ireland. They get to opt out of U.S. laws on access to data. In the case of Apple, they throw away the encryption key and don't have to worry about giving information to law enforcement, even where the owner of the phone is consented, and even where the government was actually involved in a case involving a terrorist. And so, you know, look, I think that we're in an odd situation where U.S. companies are making an active effort to avoid the application of U.S. law to their customers' data because they find it either in their economic or other interests, perhaps efficiency theaters, to simply opt out of both the Fourth Amendment requirements and the legal structures that the U.S. has created. And so that's problematic, and I think something that we don't want to encourage U.S. companies to do. And again, we should allow consumers to vote with their feet. If they don't want to contract U.S. companies because U.S. laws apply, by the way, as a general matter, U.S. laws are dramatically more protective of user privacy than any other nation's laws. Yes, in some cases, the claim is that European laws might be more protective. Truth be told, most European countries actually have both a data retention directive as well as a data privacy directive, so it's not clear that, in fact, EU laws are more protective. In a lot of ways, many European countries' laws are actually less protective and increasingly moving in that direction post-Paris and post-Brussels. So I would sort of caution against the notion somehow we have, a very loose regime where data is not protected. In fact, to the contrary, some of our rules are the strongest. And so, if you're a U.S. company, or a U.S. citizen, or frankly, a person who's interested in privacy, you're more likely to get a better outcome out of the United States government than you are out of most other governments. And so, creating a regime which encourages you to go to other governments, I think, is actually a mistake.
A quick reminder to our audience to check the Federalist Society's website and monitor your emails for announcements about upcoming Teleforum conference calls. We will have a call scheduled tomorrow on the voter ID cases. There have been three or four cases recently decided by federal courts concerning voter ID across the country. Today, of course, we're talking about the Microsoft warrants case. This is the final call for questions unless we start to get questions pouring in. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we wait, I will ask a final question myself, and that is whether or not the tech companies united here. I've seen the tech community divided over various issues, but we've talked a little bit about the tech community as if they're one on this issue. Is that the case? And if not, how does it divide itself?
I think this is Jeff. In the Microsoft case, I think it was pretty uniform that any sort of customer-facing tech company was pretty much lined up behind Microsoft. And I think that goes back to what I mentioned at the beginning, which is these are companies that aspire to be, you know, global leaders in what they do. And, you know, I think there is a very widespread perception, which, you know, I don't think is correct, but I think there is this perception in Europe that, you know, the U.S. doesn't take data privacy seriously. And so I think, you know, a holding that would have potentially opened the door to the U.S. government accessing that data by getting a warrant and then giving it to Microsoft in New York, I think that would have been really, really problematic for the future, you know, success and growth of those companies in countries outside the United States. You know, and one quick thought on you know, Jamil's point about the potential of, you know, companies sort of abusing this, which is a perfectly legitimate concern that, you know, companies, if with a rule like this, if you have one country that as a matter of local law has sort of ironclad privacy protections that data can never be produced ever under any circumstances, well, why wouldn't every company just host its data there? And I think, you know, and I think that's a logical transition to another important topic, which is that this is only a statutory holding by the Second Circuit. It's not a constitutional holding. It's not a mandatory holding. It's a holding that construes Section 2703 as written. And what the court held is that this statute, which was written in 1986 and has not been updated since then to address the internet, never contemplated, you know, never contemplated one of these warrants being used to get data in a foreign country. Now, to be sure, that may well have been because at the time the statute was passed, there was no data in foreign countries because the internet was just used by some computer scientists between, you know, MIT and Caltech. And so I do think that the concerns that Jamil raised just then lead to the question of, well, what would be a better way of doing this? And there have been a number of proposals out there, and I think a lot of tech companies are now backing legislation called the International Communications Privacy Act. And basically what that would do is it seeks to balance privacy rights and national security rights. So it's really looking at both the location and the nationality of the individual whose data is requested. So it basically sets up three levels. So what if it's a U.S. citizen or a U.S. national, ICPA would say that the government could perfectly do exactly what it did here. So if it's a U.S. citizen's email account and that citizen is traveling in Switzerland, perfectly acceptable for the government to give Microsoft a subpoena and say, we would like, you know, these emails. If it's a country that has a law enforcement agreement with the United States, then that country would basically be given a courtesy notice and a chance to object. So for example, Ireland or the EU, what would have happened is instead of going straight to Ireland, Microsoft would have, or I'm sorry, instead of going straight to Microsoft, the US would have notified Ireland, hey, we intend to ask Microsoft for these emails. If you have an objection to that, let us know. And there's a 60-day clock to avoid the problem of sort of indefinite delays. And then if Ireland didn't object, the emails could be turned over. And then I think in the third scenario, which is where it's a country that doesn't have a law enforcement cooperation agreement, the statute would basically allow the government to do what it was trying to do in the Microsoft case of just go straight to the provider. So look, all legislation has sort of pros and cons, but I think what this solution is trying to do is to ensure that the U.S. does not lose jurisdiction over people trying to game the system. And that goes exactly to the point that Jamil raised about the gamesmanship, because again, this would say, if you're a U.S. citizen, and the providers know this, I mean, they know from where people are using their accounts, where people are setting up their accounts. If you're a U.S. citizen, it doesn't matter where your account is, we're still going to have jurisdiction over it. And that's a pretty ancient notion of sovereignty, that a country retains authority over its citizens wherever they go, anywhere in the world. But at the same time, when there is a situation that could give rise to international friction, like the Ireland situation, it does extend the courtesy of notifying the country and giving it a chance to object before we barge into their citizens' emails. So, you know, and all of this, the need for legislation has been, I think, everyone from law enforcement to consumer groups to tech companies to every stakeholder imaginable has pretty much been uniform in saying whatever the new rules are, we need new rules, and they need to come through a statute that is, you know, has been updated at some point in the last 30 years rather than one that was, you know, enacted when cassette tapes were still the newest technology.
We do have a couple questions at this point, so why don't we turn now to our first caller.
Hi, Benjamin Ritz. Since we've been talking generally about privacy, and in this particular case I know it was a warrant, but if they'd used a different procedural vehicle, more like a standard subpoena, would the outcome have been different, do you believe?
Who wants to take a first shot at that?
So this is Jeff. So that's a really good question and a really hard question, because what happened here is ECPA created this really odd sort of hybrid type subpoena warrant where it's called a warrant, and there's no question that in some respects it looks like a warrant because it's directing a search of emails that the government didn't have, but it also kind of looks like a subpoena because it's being given to Microsoft to produce records within its custody and control. And so I think, unsurprisingly, courts have struggled with this for exactly the reasons you noted. And I think where the Second Circuit ultimately came down is it looks more like a warrant. And, you know, the statute uses the word warrant. And so I think the court assumed that Congress chose that word intentionally. And so I think the court was more willing to apply some of the traditional warrant rules, in particular the idea that warrants can only be executed domestically unless there's some indication that Congress intended otherwise.
Jamil Jaffer, you have anything on this point?
No, but I think Jeff is right to say that it looks like an interesting hybrid. Of course, the problem with the court's ruling in this regard is that while it may look like a warrant, has important aspects that are completely divorced from the normal warrant context. And so the notion somehow that because it has some elements that look like warrants and elements that don't, I think at the end of the day, either it's a warrant or it's not. Either it has all the features that a warrant would typically have, and for that purpose, it's a constitutional warrant and it's a statutory warrant. Fair enough. If it's not, then the fact that the fact that the term was used in the statute, I think, you know, to be sure, Congress is expected to understand the difference between a warrant and an order. But the problem here, of course, is that Congress, knowing what a warrant was, nonetheless created procedures and rules and ability to access data that otherwise would be subject to a warrant, like content data that's over a certain period, over a certain age, and treated it differently. And so, I'm not sure the court's ruling is accurate on that front. I think that's what makes this thing a challenge. Now, as far as the questioner's question about a subpoena, the answer is, at least under standing precedent, if the government had used a subpoena and a subpoena were available for this purpose, it is highly likely that Microsoft would have had to comply. In fact, that was the government's argument, that this ought to be treated like a subpoena, and in prior cases, subpoenas have been enforced against companies. Now Jeff makes this distinction between data the company has in its possession that are its business records versus data that it has on behalf of another. While that is a distinction that is not without some justification to make as a matter of U.S. law, at least, it's a distinction that doesn't make a difference in large part because the third-party doctrine, while it's been hotly debated, still stands, and data in the hands of a company, ultimately, regardless of whether it's the company's records or the content of another individual, could be produced other than if the Fourth Amendment applied and there were a Fourth Amendment reason. But at least by statute, you could require its production.
Terrific. We do have one other question pending. Let's take our second call now.
This is David Applegate, the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. The previous question and answers pretty much feed into my question, which is this. I have been trying to think of a good pre-internet analogy here, but certainly in the days of paper records, when AT&T, for example, was the only telephone company that provided service to United States citizens, it was possible for us to make long-distance calls. If I had been making, say, because Al-Qaeda and ISIS didn't exist back then, or at least we didn't hear about them, suppose I had been making calls to the Soviet Union back in the 60s and the 70s, and the government decided that it wanted to subpoena records from the telephone company, which of course it would have, because being long distance calls, I would have to be billed separately for those, or billed for those particular calls. It would not have been on any kind of monthly service plan. Why would this be any different from AT&T having said back then, well, we're sorry, but actually as a matter of convenience, because record storage is less expensive, we keep those paper records in Ireland rather than in Indianapolis or wherever. Commonly in the legal process, what you ask for, of course, are the records in the possession, custody, or control of the party from whom you're requesting them. So why is this really any different, except that we jazzed it up with electronic communications now?
Well, so this is Jeff. Go ahead, Jeff.
No, go ahead, Jeff.
No, after you.
So I think it's...
Well, I was just going to add... all right, you first.
All right. So I think it's an interesting question in part because... So imagine... So I'm going to lay out a little bit different hypothetical, right? Imagine if United Postal Service, UPS, and you're sending a package to a foreign country, right? So while that package is still in the hands of a U.S. provider, right, it was given to this U.S. provider, the government comes to that provider with a warrant that's given to us. We have a warrant from a law, from a U.S. court, right? That provider will be required to turn the package over, and the government could do whatever it needed to do with that package. Now imagine it's in transit, right, over the Atlantic Ocean, right? Unclear under this ruling what the rule is for that package, but the second it lands in Europe, in Ireland or wherever, all of a sudden now Irish law applies, or at least the U.S. government can't access it, right? And even though the provider is here, the provider had access to the package the entire time, even while it's in the provider's hands in Ireland. So a package that a U.S. warrant could have gotten while on U.S. soil, unclear what happens while it's in the air in the hands of the U.S. provider. Still in the hands of the U.S. provider overseas, now landed, all of a sudden European law applies, or at least U.S. law doesn't apply. And while the presumption against extraterritoriality might apply – see, normally when we think of the presumption against extraterritoriality, it's usually designed to protect Americans overseas such that we can't enforce U.S. criminal laws against foreigners in their home countries or necessarily Americans – overseas unless we've got custody and control over them. Here in this scenario, the U.S. government is seeking data that U.S. law allows it to have access to, that had it been on U.S. soil in the hands of U.S. provider, it would have had access to, but all of a sudden, because that U.S. provider has decided to take it overseas, whether it's because it's part of their business or out of matter of convenience or out of an effort to evade U.S. law, the second they show up in that foreign country, boom. Now, that issue is only magnified by the fact that it takes instantaneously seconds to transfer this data. So I think it's very problematic. I think for the same reasons you sort of asked the question, I think it raises significant policy questions in the United States.
Jeff Harris, a comment here?
Yeah, I was just going to add, I do think all of these lines are a little fuzzy, but at the end of the day, I do think there's something different about the contents of a communication versus the what I would call sort of metadata, loosely, to refer to sort of the more sort of procedural aspects of the communication. I think that that's also reflected in the telephone context. I mean, I don't think it would be crazy to tell the phone company, well, we just need your records. We don't want someone else's communication. We just want your records about, you know, who made the calls, who received the calls, how long the calls lasted. And when you look at, for example, the pen register statute, which has these heightened restrictions on wiretapping, I think that reflects a judgment that the content of the communication is different. And one provision that hasn't come up yet is, and largely because it wasn't at issue in the Second Circuit case, is there's actually another provision of ECPA that what it allows is, under a much lower showing, so something resembling a subpoena, for the government to obtain basic information about the email account. So, you know, who did the account belong to? What's the person's address? You know, what times were they using it? So sort of information about the account without getting to the contents of the account. You know, and I can see arguments that that's an artificial distinction, but I actually think that it's not all that different from the types of distinctions we see in, again, the Penn Register statute and the difference between, you know, information broadly about a phone call, sort of the who, what, when, and where, and then sort of the contents of the call, which I think U.S. law has always kind of recognized that this is different and this is especially deserving of privacy protection.
Well, gentlemen, we're out of questions, just about out of time, but I want to give each of you maybe 60 seconds or so to wrap up. Let's go in the reverse order we started. That means Professor Jamil Jaffer.
Well, thanks, Dean, and thanks to Jeff for a good debate. I think, look, at the end of the day, I think the question is, should U.S. law, right, and the sort of agreement we've made, whether it's the Fourth Amendment agreement on how governments get access to data and whether U.S. companies need to comply with that sort of agreement that we made at the beginning of the Republic and whether they could sort of opt themselves out of the Fourth Amendment as Apple attempted to do in the iPhone case, or whether, as Microsoft did in this case, Microsoft can opt itself out of the agreement we as a nation have made in our statutes about how the governments get access to data simply by moving its data overseas. And for me, the question is, for U.S. companies that have chosen to take advantage of U.S. law, U.S. tax regime, all the benefits of being a U.S. company, do those companies simply get the opportunity to exempt themselves out of the agreements that we have made, the sort of deals of our political branches, whether at the founding in the case of the Constitution or in the case of Congress, have made about when and how governments get access to data? And if the answer is yes, then we should be fine with Apple and the way it handled the iPhone controversy, and we should be fine with the way that Microsoft has chosen to deal with the Ireland case in the Second Circuit decision. If the answer is no, and we think that American companies ought to comply with American law and the bargain that our political branches have struck when it comes to that, then I think we've got to look very carefully at these questions and say, well, okay, if in fact this is how American companies are going to sort of, you know, handle the data, you know, does it make sense to do data localization? As a general matter, I think that is a very bad outcome for our technology industry. It's a very bad outcome for user privacy ultimately, because not only will the U.S. be able to do that, every other country that has less stringent privacy protections will be able to do that also. And I think that's net-net the bad outcome that comes from what look like sort of smart moves by Apple on the privacy of users on the iPhone and what comes from what appear to be privacy sort of security moves by Microsoft in the Ireland case. I think that we have yet to see the longer-term implications of this, particularly as Europe increasingly weakens its privacy laws, which people think are stronger, are not in fact stronger than U.S. privacy laws. As we move in that direction, I think that you know, the unintended consequences of this decision and Apple's decision with respect to the iPhone, I think, are likely to play out and not be good for privacy or good for the technology industry.
Final thought from Jeff Harris.
Great. So, yeah, and thank you as well to Dean and Jamil. This is a fun and spirited discussion about some really interesting issues. You know, and what I would leave you with is what Judge Lynch said in his concurring opinion, which is, look, I ultimately, you know, like Judge Lynch, I think the Second Circuit decision is correct, and I think that the big takeaway from my perspective, it's not about Microsoft exempting itself from U.S. law. It's about recognizing who gets to decide the level of data protection when data is physically within the borders of a certain country. And I think, you know, it shouldn't be controversial that data ultimately has to live somewhere. So even despite all this movement towards the cloud and, you know, the ability of things to cross national borders, servers are still a physical thing that have to be somewhere. And this decision just says that wherever it physically is, that's the place that gets to regulate it. But in all events, although the Second Circuit's decision is correct, I think there's no question that the statutes here are horrifically out of date. And, you know, the Second Circuit's decision is only a statutory holding. It's not a constitutional holding. It's subject to revision by Congress. And so I think the one big takeaway for everyone should be that, you know, however Congress ultimately comes down, this area of the law is desperately in need of a comprehensive overhaul for the first time since 1986.
Well, gentlemen, we're out of time, out of questions, but I thank you both very much for joining us today. We certainly appreciate it. It's been an interesting conversation. To our callers, thank you for joining in with your questions. A reminder that our next scheduled telephone conference call tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number, we'll be talking about the voter ID cases. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.